This week on the podcast, we are going somewhere special. I'm taking you home with me, back to Pittsburgh and the Italian-American community I grew up in. McKees Rocks, Pennsylvania is about 10 miles west of the city of Pittsburgh. If Little Italy were a thing in Pittsburgh, this would be it. Italian Americans immigrated mostly from the southern part of Italy, landed here in droves at the turn of the century. And having now visited actual southern Italy, I see the appeal of the rocks, at least in its heyday, as it's affectionately known around Pittsburgh, for some of those early Italian settlers. The roads and the streets carved into the side of small mountains and steep hills, the way the trees get lush and green in the spring, the proximity to water, though Pittsburgh's three rivers are really nothing compared to Italy's coast. But if you take an Italian and plop them just about anywhere, we figure out pretty quickly how to stick together and build something special. To hear anyone from the rocks tell it, this was the place to be when the greatest generation, my grandparents' generation, came home from the war to nest. The 40s, 50s, and 60s, and maybe a touch into the 70s. It had everything. The people, the entertainment, soda fountains, restaurants, theaters, streets peppered with benches and sidewalks that led you to countless neighborhood parks. And like any other Italian-American community, it also had faith. There was a church almost on every corner. And of course, it had the food. The food. When you grow up Italian-American in the rocks or near the rocks, like I did, food isn't just something you eat. It's something you do. Your mom makes homemade pasta and lays it to dry on towels while you head out to Sunday Mass. The sauce, yes, it's sauce, not gravy in Pittsburgh, simmers on the stovetop all Sunday, flavored by Italian sausage and hunks of beef. You line entire tables, yes, you heard that right, tables, with dozens and dozens of Italian cookies for communion parties and weddings. Cookie tables are a real thing in Pittsburgh, just Google it. McKees Rocks, these days, has had a bit of a fall from grace, you could say. Crime is high. Those tiny row houses lining the steep streets where my parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles grew up, dilapidated to a point of near condemnation, at least in some places. But you can't steal the magic from the rocks, and that's because of the people who built it. I count my family in that cast of characters just as much as I count the subject of today's interview. Joe Costanzo founded an Italian restaurant in McKees Rocks called the Prima Donna that, just like the rocks itself, had its golden era. It was the place to go to for Italian-American food. Crisp fried zucchini, spaghetti and meatballs that would just spill off your dinner plate, eggplant parm dripping in mozzarella, the kind of recipes passed down from your great-grandmother that have that perfect blend of old-world influence and that new world, or Medagan, as my pap would say, twist. Joe operated that restaurant, serving the likes of Danny Aiello, Pat Sajak, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Tommy Lasorda. Word is, Frank Sinatra even got takeout from there once. But mostly, he served the people of McKees Rocks and just beyond. People really traveled to get to this place, and it thrived until it didn't. And Joe ended up in jail. I'll let his daughter Maria, today's guest, tell that story. But I thought you should understand a little bit about the world that that restaurant inhabited before you hear the interview. Because it's not just about the life and death of a restaurant. It's about the life and death of a reputation and what it takes to build that back. It's about the kind of people who embrace you with that passionate, fiery, hug and smack you on the back kind of loyalty and then turn around and do you dirty. Enough to send you away from that restaurant and life and reputation you built and away from your family. And it's about the lessons that they and you and your family learn as it all unfolds. Some of it's great, some of it's not, but it's all life. And in Maria's new book, On the Rocks, she goes through what it was like to see her dad, a community legend, a man who loved those people just as much as someone could love people, not family, a man with a big and bursting personality, both rise and fall. It's a story for people who've gone through trauma of any kind. And it's a story about how that trauma reverberates. It's also a story about how they rebound. I hope you enjoy this interview with Maria as we dive into all of this and more. You don't have to be from the rocks to take some important life lessons from it. Enjoy.
prendila e stringila, è un'emozione candida.
All right, hey guys, today's episode is a treat for me in so many ways. You know, I love to bring you engaging conversations with, you know, people with stories to tell or experts, but rarely do I get to bring onto the podcast people that I've pretty much known most of my life. And today that is the case. Not only though is she a friend, but she's also the author, as you heard in the intro, of a really great book with themes that I think will really resonate with anyone, no matter who you are or where you grow up. Although we do know Maria Costanzo, Maria Palmer, I guess I should say. Pittsburgh is the best place to grow up.
You can call me Maria Costanzo. You'll always be Sunny Abada to me.
You know what? I told my dad, you didn't have any sons, but I kept my last name professionally. So there you go.
Heck yeah. So
we gave a little bit of info on the book in the intro, Maria. And it's, even though this book, we know it won Best Narrative Nonfiction 2023 from the American Book Fest. And it is a retelling of sorts. It's a biography. It's nonfiction. It also reads like a really good, you know, potential movie script. I mean, it's got all the makings. It's got the small Italian-American, you know, guy made good, the twist and turn of going to prison, what that meant for you and for him and your whole family. So there's so many like interesting threads that I'm excited to get into. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited about this. And I feel the same way. I'm on so many different interviews, but it's rare that I'm on an interview with somebody that I essentially have known my entire life. So this is a treat for me.
Parents know each other too. I mean,
we're all friends. The Costanzas and the Abadas are, we're all friends.
We go way back. And this is actually strikes to the heart of how I want to open up this conversation. There's something that's really hard to articulate about where we grew up, which is right outside of Pittsburgh, really strong Italian American community. How do you describe where we grew up to people? And we should reference, the book is set in McKees Rocks, which is where our parents grew up. We both grew up right outside there up the road, Robinson Township. But how do you describe like the insular, crazy, amazing, difficult, weird way that, that we grew up in our community?
Well, you summed it up pretty well right there. I think that it was a very unique place at a very unique time. So for people who are unfamiliar with Pittsburgh history and McKees Rocks history in particular, this was a very booming place around the time of the steel mill era, which is obviously what Pittsburgh is known for. And what was very interesting to me, I kind of have a story about this, but I'll set the scene of what McKees Rocks was actually like during that time, whenever people were migrating over from Italy, from Poland, many other areas. I think, you know, you go to who you know. And I think what had happened was the first boats of people came over, they migrated, they settled in McKees Rocks, and then more of their friends came over. And that's kind of how the neighborhood built. Mm-hmm. How I picture the neighborhood is how it was whenever we were younger and growing up. And even the opening scene, my writing partner, who I want to give a big shout out to, who Sunny knows very well, Ruthie, used to be Dines. She was Mrs. Dines when we had her in school, but now Robbins. She grew up in the area during the 50s and 60s, and she paints this really beautiful picture in the opening scene of the book, talking about the cobblestone streets and the little mom and pop shops and the community overall and all of the events that you didn't have to leave the area for, the church festivals, which are always my favorite growing
best food ever.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the food, which was made by our grandparents, basically, you know, you pay $2 and you get a homemade bowl of pasta that you couldn't get here in New York City for $250. It was just, we were spoiled in a way that we didn't understand, maybe not through money and riches, but through culture. It's a city. I'll tell you a story about somebody that we actually went to high school with. I'll give Anthony Mitri a shout out. Mm-hmm. He went and he visited Calabria. the McKees Rocks area is really populated, or at the time was very much populated by Southern Italians.
Yes.
And my family's Calabrese. I think yours is too, right, son? Mm-hmm. And so he went to Calabria and he was just poking around in these local little villages. And I think he ended up going to the library and he met the mayor, because I guess that's what happens in Calabria. You just walk around the little town and all of a sudden somebody notices that you don't belong and they need to meet you. And whenever he met the mayor, he said, you know, clearly you're not from here. Where are you from? And he said, oh, I'm from the United States. And, you know, I'm just doing a little family research. And he said, it's just so interesting to me because my family's last name is Mitri, but, you know, I went to school with the Abadas and the Costanzos, and, you know, starts just kind of naming all of these other McKees Rock staple people. And, you know, the mayor said to him, that's really interesting that you are from the United States and that you're from Pittsburgh. I'm not familiar with Pittsburgh, although I do fly into Pittsburgh every year to visit my family, but they are from an area just outside of Pittsburgh called McKees Rocks, PA.
Oh my God, stop it. It's true, we are all related. We joke about that.
We are all related, but I think that, you know, I wanted to highlight that story because first of all, it's very Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh mm-hmm. people know Pittsburgh people. They love Pittsburgh people. There's, you know, always, I know there's that whole 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. I feel like in Pittsburgh, it's like, you'd be lucky if there's 2 degrees. I mean, people are just, they're much, much more closely related.
If I'm not related, I mean, I joke I'm related to half of the rocks, but if I'm not related to someone, they are related to like a cousin of mine. Like there are dozens and dozens of cousins. And even if, you know, your parents grew up with someone and they weren't blood related, you're still a cousin to them. Like yeah. How many people I called uncle so-and-so or aunt that we weren't even related to? This just the sense of like, community and family is so strong. I think I naively thought that that was like how most people grew up. It was insular in a way, but also me exposed too. Us. Yeah. It did also expose us though, to a lot of like, it wasn't, you know, overly sheltered of a growing up experience either. But I grew up thinking, yeah, the whole world's like Italian and Catholic and they're probably related to my mom or dad somehow. You know, it's just.
Yes, 100%. I actually, in college, I think you'll find this funny. In college, I didn't know for Thanksgiving. This is 100% the truth, right? I'm 18 years old, going to be 19 years old, going off to college. And I meet people from all over the country and all over the world. I didn't know that people, whenever they had Thanksgiving, that they just had turkey and mashed potatoes and stuff. Like, I thought everybody also had pasta and raviolis, because that's just how we did everything. But it wasn't just my family. It was every family that we grew up with. So that when that's normal for you, that becomes your norm.
Right. And
I don't know. There's something very beautiful about that, because you're right. That's not replicated in other places. Even, you know, I'm in Jersey now, which is a super Guido area. And I don't.
We say that with love.
Like that. Yes. We say that with total love. Yes.
We say it because we are them.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't feel like it's got that same richness that places like McKees Rocks do. You know, it's just basically you scooped out a bunch of people from Italy that were trying to make a better life for themselves. You put them in this area in Pennsylvania, right outside of Pittsburgh, and they in essence became their own family. And, you know, strangely enough, my parents did not grow up in the Rocks. My parents grew up on the east side of Pittsburgh, but because my dad became such a staple to McKees Rocks, they've kind of adopted him as the redheaded stepchild. Like he is the Rocks. Like whenever you think of McKees Rocks, you cannot think of Joe Costanzo.
Yeah. I mean, the forefront and to paint a picture for you guys too, because like, I think, you know, people who haven't been there might not be familiar. When Maria said it was like a small town in and of itself, it had the main street feel with like the brick houses, the bakery, the butcher, the cookie place, the pizza place. There was a church there still is, even if they're not operational, on every corner. I mean, yep. It was, and I remember driving through and my pap would be like, I built that bridge and I fixed this one. And my papa, my dad's dad, baked at Mancini's Bakery. And there's the picture of that on our wall. I mean, just like the tie-ins are extremely deep. And that's the sense of community that lays the foundation for your book. And I love that you brought people in there, because in order to understand what a big deal it is, what your dad went through going to prison for tax evasion, like the shock of the community, you have to understand how much he was loved, known, appreciated, how much he brought to the community. It was just, it was wild. It's a redemption story at the end of the day. I wonder if you feel that way too. It's kind of the arc of redemption really strongly sort of plays through it. It's his come up. It's his crash down. And it's his like pop back up into realizing, it seems to me, like what life really is all about. Family.
Yeah. I think that, you know, you put that in a very beautiful way. And one of the things, whenever we were shopping this out to agents and publishers, one of the criticisms that we were getting was, this is just a regional story. Nobody outside of Pittsburgh that has not heard of this restaurant is going to be interested in it. And I was very quick to disagree. And I said, you know, this story comes at a time where there's so much dissension in our world. There are people on, you know, opposite sides that are screaming at one another, not willing to bend because I believe one thing and you believe another thing. And there's so much dissension. And I think that right now as a society, we need something that's going to pull us all back together. And I think that the elements of resiliency and what makes us, the duality of a human, what makes us human and what makes us whole, and not all decisions that people make are going to be 100% the right ones all the time. I mean, I make mistakes all the time.
But you know what? You know what? Growing up, like, you know, we weren't in the rocks per se, but I mean, we were, my family was all there. We were there every weekend. My dad, you know, whatever, that's where my parents are from. We're 5 minutes from it.
Yep.
It instilled in me. And I wonder if you feel the sense of this too, your dad having been such a big part of that community in particular, that I'm not better than anyone. No, I'm not. Yes. The decisions I make are the decisions I make. And yeah, maybe I made a decision that led me down a better path that the next guy didn't. But you're not better than anyone. You treat everyone with respect for your elders. You work hard. You work so hard. So close to that immigrant mentality, right? I remember my grandfather would say, like, it wasn't even a thought. My mom just didn't go to college because he was just a sixth grade educated poor kid from Southern Italy. And so
my grandparents growing up,
you're going to do better. Mm-hmm. Every generation you're going to do better. And it's really, you know, it feels like it looks like, and it certainly is more rough and tumble than it has been in, over the past few decades, but it's still a core place where you can find great people.
Yes.
There's really good people.
Yeah. I think it's the fabric of the salt of the earth of America. And I 100% agree with you. Whenever you grow up in and around that area, you will always stay humble. You just will. And, you know, I find I'm so blessed because I went to Syracuse University for my undergrad and then Pepperdine for my master's degree. And I always say that the best education I got was right there in the rocks, working at the Prima Donna, because you interact with the public. And you're right, there is an era of respect that was just something that was part of the community norm there. You respect your elders. You work really hard because guess what? Your ancestors who came over, they busted their butts. I mean, my great grandfather came over. He stayed in America for 7 years before his wife and her three young children, one that was a baby, came back to the United States, because that's just how poor people were. And when you come from nothing and you rise above, you have this just amazing work ethic in you. You have this appreciation for life and for the things that you have. And, you know, it means something to you. And those relationships, I feel like, that you embark upon too, they're deep. It's not, you know, what can you do for me? It's like, how do I bring you into my fold? Yes. How do yes. I make you part of me? Because mm-hmm. we all are kind of cut from that same cloth, and how can we help each other here? And mm-hmm. I think that that's the overall tone that you get in McKee's Rocks. We just did on Tuesday night, my mom actually, for the first time ever, and you know, my mom, Sunny, she's very classy, but she's not one that likes to be in the spotlight. And she told her story on Tuesday at the McKee's Rocks Historical Society. Right. And it was just so wonderful to see all of the people that kind of came out. And again, it's a very come as you are kind of place. Yeah. I mean, we were at Mickey's Bar, which used to be Kennedy's Tavern, which mm-hmm. is filled with smoke, you know, like as you walk in, it's like,
I've got its own ozone depletion happening above it.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, it's a wonderful place, and everybody is just so friendly and just so supportive. I think what's been amazing just about this story, and I won't get ahead of myself, but I think that people have enjoyed it for what it is, but people who have ties to Pittsburgh, specifically to McKee's Rocks, have said that the opening scene that really Ruthie gets all the credit for, because I didn't grow up there, I don't know what was there or anything like that back in the 50s and 60s, but they're buying the book for that opening scene because they're saying that the book is taking them back to the way that things used to be mm-hmm. in a town that they just love so much. And that to me is so cool that it's reaching places like Florida and California and overseas, because people have their roots and their veins run deep to the rocks.
Well, and it's that theme is really transferable. Anyone who has displaced themselves or been in a minority position in any way can really relate to what it takes to move to a new place, set roots down, scramble to find a way to support your family, do everything it takes to get there. Your dad's restaurant, and for anyone who's not familiar with Pittsburgh in general, Prima Donna Restaurant, it was a place of community in addition to having great food. And we would go in, you would get, you know, Joe would come over to the table every time. We get our zucchini, we get our bottle of salad dressing. I mean, the whole thing. And so when we're going through his story, and you really walk us through the step up, right? The work he did to get there, being embraced by the community. You talk about, I love this, and I didn't know this, doing takeout for Frank Sinatra. insane, right? So he's looking for like legends, right? And you see him growing his confidence and growing his stature in the community, and you see it and you almost feel like, oh God, something's coming, you know?
Oh no, yeah.
Before we get to, take me back to the golden years. So this you do a really good job sort of setting the sensory experience in the book, but for someone who was walking into the Prima Donna during its heyday, give us that sensory description of how it might look like, feel, smell, be, the vibe, all of it.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the main things that he started very early on was that he was not going to take any reservations. And I think that was part of just the makeup of who he is. You know, I'm, you know, like we had talked about, nobody's more important than anybody else. It's just come and you wait in line. So at the heyday of the Prima Donna, after our first big review, the line was all the way down Broadway, right down, yes, down the street, right on the sidewalk. And people would start waiting at 3 or 3:30 for a 4 o'clock opening. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the doors open, I always liken it, because I don't think that in the hospitality industry, we do this anymore, or maybe some people do it, but it's now the minority and not the majority. I always liken it to a Broadway show, right? Like you have your main actors, but then you have all of these other pieces. You have stagehands, you have people that create the set, you have people that are doing special effects, you have people that are doing makeup, costumes. And if it's done correctly, you don't realize all of the individual parts. It moves as one machine. Mm-hmm. And so whenever you walked into the Prima Donna and you were greeted in this, you know, long entryway by Joe, that was sort of your entrance into this whole experience. And the waiting was actually, I think, part of that. It kind of created, you were hungry, you were smelling these wonderful smells that were coming out of the kitchen, but you were also anticipating a night that was yet to be. Mm-hmm. And then after you sat down, like you said, Joe has a way of making everybody feel like you're the most important person in the room.
He does.
No matter whether you're Joe Schmo from across the street or you're Tommy Lasorda, Danny Aiello, Jamie Lee Curtis, Frank Sinatra, he has this innate people skills type of personality where he can just sort of come in and really make you feel like you're at our family's home. You know, this is how we do our Sunday dinners, our holidays. And I think that fried zucchini, not only is it delicious and I have dreams about it all the time, but I think that it was a nice way to break the ice because he was giving most people, I think all people that came in there, a free fried zucchini appetizer, you know, as you kind of perused the menu and the specials. And, you know, back, and a lot of restaurants don't do this anymore either, just because the overhead costs are so high, but he had 32 different pasta dishes. Each pasta dish was 1 pound of uncooked pasta. That's a whole box.
What?
Of pasta.
They were giant plates. I remember
they were
that,
giant plates. I mean, I still to this day have some like serious bicep muscles just from carrying those plates and, you know, some tendonitis problems in my wrist as a result. But he had such a menu to really choose from. And he also had immigrant people working in the kitchen. I mean, my family and many other people's family that made everything from scratch. And I think that that was key because in McKee's Rocks, the food was amazing. If you were going to somebody's house, it was amazing.
You cannot over describe the amount of insanely delicious food. Teresa's Bakery, Mancini's. Yeah. I mean, like, whatever. Those are just the well known, like, everything. Everyone's home had good fresh food.
You could walk up to any rinky dink apartment or anything in McKee's Rocks. And I'm telling you, it would have been equivalent, if not better, to a Michelin star restaurant. And my dad knew this. So one of the things that he knew that he had to do is he needed to bring very authentic Southern Italian food because the people in the Rocks would have called him on it if it was not. And they would not have come because why are you going to go out if your food is amazing at home? And everybody's food in that area was amazing at home. Right. I was, you know, whenever I went to college, everybody talks about the freshman 15, the freshman 15. I lost 15 to 20 pounds going to college because I was bereft of all of that amazing food. I mean, we just grew up in a place that just hit it out of the park with food. And to this day, whenever I do any events, I just did a cook and book class this weekend in Pittsburgh. I'm always a little hesitant because I know that the people that show up at this event, you know, a good majority of them can definitely cook me under the table. It's true, you know, because that's just the type of people that we were around. But bringing that authentic food, but bringing the experience. And, you know, whenever people walked out, like you said, they're walking out with salad dressing. They're walking out as family, Maria. They're coming in as strangers. They're walking out as friends and family.
So, okay, I have to hop in here because I know, and so many people know, the love that was felt from Joe to his customers, the environment he created. I always wondered and wanted to ask you who could betray someone like that? Like Laws Schmaus, like who would want to bring down a guy that was doing good? Maria, it like gets the goat.
Yes, I 100% agree with you. This is why I was in therapy for many years because I really couldn't come to terms with who would do something like that either. I'm at peace now, and I feel like my family is at peace now. And one of the things that I do want to say is if this would have happened today, I think there would have been a very different course of action.
How so?
Well, at the time, there were these federal mandated minimums of if you served if you did a particular crime and you were found guilty at a particular severity, jail time or prison time was a must. Mm-hmm. So those mandatory minimum laws that were back in the Clinton administration are now unconstitutional. That's number one. So this could have been handled civilly, and my father asked for it to be handled civilly. The other thing that was very unique about it is, like you said, it was somebody else who mentioned his name in a federal grand jury investigation. And although that was a very tough pill for me to swallow for a very long time, I am a person that has a lot of empathy for others. And so I realized that probably why this person, it probably did stem from some jealousy, right? But probably why this person ultimately did this is they were getting in trouble. They themselves were being investigated.
Right.
The federal government is really good at convicting people, like over 99% conviction rate. If they want you, they're going to get you.
Right.
So for him, a get out of jail free card was to mention somebody else who the government could be interested in. And so at the time, my dad seemed like a no-brainer because he was incredibly successful in an area that was not known for incredibly successful restaurants, but before a time of StreamYard and YouTube and social media and Facebook and Instagram, he was a destination whenever there were no Google directions or maps. So to anybody who, you know, let's give this person the benefit of the doubt. Let's say that they weren't jealous. It seemed like low-hanging fruit to mention my dad. And
like, don't get me, I'm going to give you the big fish. Like, let me out. I'm going to give you a big fish. Don't even waste your energy with me, Chase. Go look at Joe.
Exactly. Right. Go look at Joe. How is somebody who's not even from McKees Rocks, which it's a very insular town, coming into McKees Rocks? How is he having all these celebrities down there, sports stars? How is he busy from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until 2 o'clock in the morning every single day? He has 83 seats in his restaurant and he's serving 300 and 400 dinners a night on a Saturday night. How does that even make sense? Mm. How does it make sense? Mm. And so I think the government was like, you got a point, you know, let's see how it makes sense. And my dad is also, and Sonny will laugh about this because you know him so well, but he's also not one to be quiet. So with all of his successes, and again, he deserved it, but he publicized the heck out of things. When he ran for political office, he was out there right in front of everybody, you know, saying all of the good that he really wanted to do for McKees Rocks. He wanted to bring in a community center similar to the amazing work that Father Regis Ryan is doing right now. He wanted to bring in a pool. He wanted to do all of these things for the community that I think, you know, it the perception of how other people thought he was maybe a little larger than what the reality was. And I think that that also made him a very easy target.
Was it hard for you as a daughter? I know you referenced going to therapy for this, but to let that go because, you know, sorry, that's Romeo in the background.
Wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Wherefore art thou? Romeo art at my feet and at the window constantly during these interviews. Hey, go on. Go to the glue factory. Just kidding. I love it.
We're going to edit that piece out. No. you'll have PETA calling you.
I know. It's a joke, everybody. But you know, what did it look like for you letting that go? Forgiveness? Because it is such an insular little environment, people know people and who know people and they talk and they, oh my God, did you hear blah, blah, blah. Like you had to have, as his daughter, felt the pressure of the town gossip or, you know, sure. people just curious about your thoughts. What did your healing look like as a family member of someone? Because I think there are a lot of people who can relate to this from that perspective. Maybe they weren't the ones who were betrayed or who had to spend time in prison or who had to go through a very public image rehabilitation, but you're the one who loves that person. So how did that specifically look for you?
It was a really hard time. So I think a very key element to the story, and On the Rocks is told in the first person perspective of my father. So as you read it, if I've done my job okay, you're going to feel like you're sitting down with my father at the bar rail, and he's going to be telling you all of these stories about how things used to be. A key part of the story is whenever I was a junior in college, I was at home in between jobs. I think I had 4 jobs over the summer. Again, work ethic, craziness, not much work-life balance. And there was a knock on my door, and it was 2 federal agents with badges looking for my dad. And, you know, my first thought was that somebody died, because that's what you see on the movies. My second thought, whenever they told me that nobody had died, because I immediately asked them about that, was that they were coming to question my dad about somebody that he may have known. Now, this might seem odd to people that are listening, but whenever you're in the restaurant and hospitality industry, you're dealing with everybody in the public. And in the 17 or 18 years that my father was in business, we had over 1 million people come in and be customers at the Prima Donna. So if you think about like 1 million people, out of that 1 million people, there are going to be some really stand-up people. And then there's going to be a handful of people that you're like, they're shady, right? So I had thought that they were coming to question my dad about somebody that he may have known. Mm-hmm. Not him. Whenever I realized hours after because he wasn't home, he was at the restaurant at the time. And I sent them down to the restaurant with my dad's blessing. He said, have them come down to the restaurant and I'll talk to them. And whenever it had hit the hour mark and my dad wasn't calling me, my dad's kind of an excellent communicator. So whenever it had hit the hour mark and he was not calling me at all, I knew that something was likely wrong. And whenever it sort of hit that 3-hour mark and I had kept on calling down at the restaurant and people were answering and saying that he was in a meeting and that he was busy, I sort of knew that something just wasn't so good. And being a really highly anxious person myself, I took this news really hard. Because also at first too, my dad had to sort through to see what the next steps were. So he wasn't running and telling my mom or my sister right away, or his sister, his mother. So for the first little bit of this was kind of a secret that was kept between the two of us. And I think being 20 years old, that was not good for my mental health. The healing process has been very much a roller coaster. I think in a lot of ways, this book has created a major healing for all of us. But in the beginning, it was a lot of disbelief, very similar to the grief process, anger, disbelief, not being able to wrap my head around what was going on, sadness, you know, a sense of betrayal. I left Pittsburgh very soon after that. That was the summer of my junior year of college. I left Pittsburgh that next year as soon as I could. And I got on a plane and went to Los Angeles, 3,000 miles away, because I was hoping that my problems wouldn't follow me. But as everybody knows, they definitely hop in your carry-on luggage and come with you. And whenever I got to LA, I was at such a raw point in my life. And I think that I'm fairly, I mean, again, everybody has growth moments. I could definitely be better on certain things. And I know that, and I'm constantly growing and trying to improve my own self. But when I got to LA, I just remember feeling like I could not even communicate, even the silliest things. We would go to a restaurant and the specials, somebody would come over and give us a whole list of specials. And a restaurant is my jam. That's where I grew up, right? I could not make a decision for my life. And those decisions created so much panic and anxiety for me that I would just cry and run out. And it took really a lot of me just kind of coming to grips and, you know, meeting your monster, I would say, in order for things to get better. You know, I would walk down the street and I consider myself a fairly friendly person. I really didn't talk too much, not to my friends. I know that even over that time, Sunny, we lost touch too, which I'm very regretful and sorry about.
But you don't owe an apology for that. No. I mean, it was noticeable though, you know, you could, but Maria, when someone is mourning and you were mourning not only where your dad physically was, but sometimes when betrayal happens, you mourn the version of that person you thought you knew or the public thought they knew, or you mourn for your mom and who's temporarily without her partner and your sister who's also going through. Like, I have so much compassion for that. And I think, I think most people, can't speak for everyone in your life probably did, or at least some of them. I would hope so.
I think so. I mean, I think all of my close compadres really did understand and they were incredibly supportive. But for me, when you go through something like that, there's no rule book. And I thought at that time, because I became much more reclusive, I really didn't talk or say hi to people or anything like that, because I really thought in my gut that if I opened my mouth, people would be able to say, that had never met me before, would be able to say on the street, there's something wrong with that girl. There's something wrong with her. And I really truly believe that. I really in my gut believe that there was something wrong with me, because my mind just wasn't functioning at the level that it once was, because I was in this like really deep state of mourning and disbelief and grief.
And how did your dad address that with you? And quickly remind me how long he was in, and how, I also want to know, cause a lot of us are parents listening, and like this, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of sympathetic, of grief that we feel on behalf of our children is so massive. So I want to know how he addressed that with you, but how long was he in?
So he was in the investigation, I think, was the worst. That was about a 3-year time frame, really long investigation. And I always say in life, it's better to just have an answer than to be in limbo, even if the answer is bad, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
He was in the Morgantown Men's Federal Facility for 5 months. And then he had 5 months of probation and house arrest per se. But, you know, it was kind of loose after that. But I think the investigation was the hardest part to take, because everybody was looking at a fine-tooth comb at things related to our family and, you know, people that we were associating with. And employees at the restaurant were being questioned. And that in itself is really tough. My dad is a really wonderful person, and he feels all the feels. So he's this big, burly Italian guy, but he's watching a Snuggles commercial on TV and he's crying, like really big tears, really, really big tears. So he's really emotional. And for him, the hardest part was how this affected all of us. I think that if he were single without a family or without any children, he would have just done it, right? He would have just done his time. And, you know, some of the funniest parts of the book, which was really hard to get him to talk about at first, are his times in prison, because you see the skills that he developed in the rocks as this people person, this entrepreneur, this head of the prima donna. That takes place also in the prison. And he becomes this person that, knows how to make other people feel special and knows whenever people are having a rough day. And he brings that compassion to a place that's not known for compassion. So I love that parallel between the story. You know, he did okay. And I'm not downgrading anybody's experience. If you've had a loved one in prison, it's awful. It's not something that anybody wants to go through. But for my dad, it wasn't really like Shawshank. You know, it was a time where he went away. He did what he had to do. And, you know, he was able to get along and use a lot of those same people skills and survival skills that he had at the Prima Donna. But I do think it weighed on him. I do think that he felt really bad and really guilty for everything that happened and all the stuff that he put the entire, well, not him, but all the stuff that the person that mentioned his name in the federal grand jury investigation put our family through. I think he felt awful.
Yeah. And you have that benefit of perspective as a parent now too. You know, you started going through this as a single person, and over the course of, like we called it, you know, that redemption arc, you've been single, married without kids, now married with kids. And now, like, you know, your kids are growing up. And so you have the benefit of multiple perspectives on that. And I just, you know, a lot of people who experience trauma, I love to walk through how that healing looks, because trauma can come in a lot of forms. And I think, like, you know, it's most important for people to know that they're not alone in this type of thing. And you just also never know what someone's going through. I mean, you know, here you are, you're at Syracuse, Pepperdine, you're accomplishing really serious things, amazing things in your life, and you're getting married and celebrating your family. And you have, you know, all of this to go through. And it just gives a case for not judging a book by its cover.
Yeah, no, for sure. We have no idea what people are going through. There was a meme that had went around on social media a few months ago, and I just thought it was so well done. It talked about this woman waiting in line buying bananas at the grocery store, and her father had just died. And she's standing in the line buying these bananas because she needed them for her household. But you know, the person in line, I guess, was just very kind to her and maybe let her go before them and gave her a smile. And it's just little things like that, because we have no idea the heavy stuff that's facing us or other people. And so whenever we can enter the world with not only just a place of gratitude for whatever it is, even if it's for like a flushing toilet that day, but a moment of grace for people, you know, sometimes at somebody's hardest moments, they can be short with us, or they could say things that they maybe don't mean. But having the grace to say, okay, this is much less about how this person is treating me and much more about what's going on for that person. I think if we all did that in this world, it would be a lot better place, you know? And I think on the healing too, for anybody that's going through something tough right now, we want to avoid things because, you know, we're taught to avoid pain or avoid things that hurt us. But one of the most helpful things in my journey, there's been a lot that's been helpful, but one of the most helpful things is I went to a presentation very early on whenever my dad was in prison to this crazy Catholic nun, Sister Suzanne Jabro, who started this organization called Get on the Bus. She's basically my dad in a female form. She's crazy. She swears.
Yeah.
She gambles. She just says whatever the heck she wants. And she started this organization to take children to go see their incarcerated parents for Mother's Day and Father's Day. And at the time it was just Mother's Day. And as she was telling this story of how this all got together, very Josie-like, you know, people, she was going to bring a delegation of Catholic women to visit women in the prison. And the women went around and said, oh, it's
Catholics to make you feel even more guilty for the crime.
Exactly. Exactly. And they said, hey, you know what? Like, it's great that these people are coming up, but we don't see our own families. So why would we want to see these strangers? And she said, what? You don't see your own kids? How long has it been? Between 4 and 17 years that had been since they had saw their children. So she goes, all right, that's it. We're getting a bus. And of course, the Catholic diocese, you can't get a bus. This is an insurance situation. And, you know, you're going to get sued. And she goes, I'm getting a bus. I don't care what anybody says. So that's how this organization was born.
Right.
And I loved what she was doing so much. And so I started speaking on behalf of the organization, telling my story, because as she said, I wasn't scary to bring into right. these Anglo-Saxon type areas. And then it just stemmed on a fluke. The director quit and she needed somebody to replace her. And I started as the director, and I thought that I was going to make such a big impact and change other people's lives. And that's, I mean, maybe to a degree, the volunteers that I worked with did that. But really right. what happened is that the family started to teach me things about myself that I needed yeah. to know about yeah. forgiveness and healing and moving on and not carrying shame right. and guilt for the rest of your life. Yeah. And that in itself was kind of a beautiful start to a lifelong journey of mental health recovery for me.
Maria, I'm so grateful that you did this and were willing to focus on that aspect with us today, you know, the healing and what it looks like to be on the other side of all this. The story is so juicy. I can't encourage people enough, Pittsburgh connection or not, but especially if you have a Pittsburgh connection, to check out this book. It's on Maria's screen too, but it's called On the Rocks. It's available on Amazon. And tell us where else we can get in touch with you, Maria, because I know sure. you're doing some really fun events, like you said, to promote the book, the cooking yeah. book, which sounds so up my alley, but tell us how to connect with you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So my website is www.mariacpalmer.com, just like on the screen, palmer.com. And you can connect with me on social media. For Facebook and Instagram, I'm at Joe Costanzo, C-O-S-T-A-N-Z-O, prima donna, like the restaurant, P-R-I-M-A-D-O-N-N-A. And really, I post all of my events. I do some really fun cooking classes and book discussions. I do book discussions. I'm able to be public with this in a couple of days, but I'll give you a little teaser. We're going to start doing a quarterly prima donna night in Pittsburgh. Oh, so, which is going to be super duper fun. So just, you know, the opportunities have been amazing, and I'm always up for whatever. I do virtual book clubs, really whatever. You can always email me at mariacpalmer@yahoo.com and would be happy to accommodate you in whatever way that I can. So
I'm just so grateful that you took time to hang with me today. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sunny. This was so much fun. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of We Gotta Talk. Please leave a rating and review. 5-star ratings and reviews help a huge amount in getting this podcast out to people who might like it or find it useful. Thanks so much for your support of We Gotta Talk. Follow me on Instagram at Sunny Abata and check out our latest blog posts at wegottatalk.com/blog. So chiudi gli occhi, immagina.